The New Statesman podcast is sponsored by Uber. It's coming up to 3 years since Uber and the GMB union signed a landmark recognition agreement, the first of its kind in the gig economy.
Having that recognition with GMB union shows that Uber's serious about drivers' protection.
Ali Haydor drives with Uber and he works as a representative for the GMB union.
The workers contract what the drivers have got is thanks to GMB. They're getting sick pay, national living wage, holiday pension. They're also able to choose the hours they want to work and the days they want to work. Also, they get to choose the jobs they want to do. Now, that is a proper work-life balance. It's full flexibility at the same time as good standard of wage there.
A wide range of issues come from all over the country from our members, and we'll take these issues to the company, discuss with the management, and the team will actually accommodate that. Now, you couldn't get that kind of access on a collective voice if you didn't have the recognition agreement.
Find out more by listening to our special episode titled Reshaping the Gig Economy. Find it in the New Statesman podcast feed now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Stephen, and on this week's New Statesman interview, I'm joined by John Elledge to talk about his new book, The Compendium of Not Quite Everything. So I'm joined by Citymetric founder, NS columnist, map botherer, John Elledge.
Hello. This is very exciting. I've not been in this room for ages. Have you made it all fancy?
Yeah, we've, as you see, it looks, I think it's a bit like a Pokemon evolution, right? And then the last time you were here, this really looked like a room. And now it kind of looks a little bit like a studio. And
it's a room that's cosplaying as a studio these days.
Yeah,
it's getting there.
It's.
And I didn't have to assemble any microphones when I walked in. That's a change from the old days.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. We're lean. We're mean.
I think after 18 months inside, none of us are lean. But
we're definitely mean, and we're green, or as I think we're now meant to call it, ESG. That's a very niche joke for anyone who works in advertising or marketing there. Anyway, moving swiftly on, the reason why you're here today is you've written a book called The Compendium of Everything.
The Compendium of Not Quite Everything. It's a very important distinction. I don't want to give people a misleading impression of quite how much of the world is covered in this slim volume.
But yeah, it's kind of like, before I describe it, do you have a bookshelf in your toilet?
I do not, but I know exactly what you mean. I have a couple of books that live in the bathroom.
Yeah.
It is very much a book you can imagine living in a bathroom. I mean, like I think when I was touting for people to say nice things about it, which is a painful and embarrassing but unfortunately necessary part of the book writing process, our former colleague Helen Lewis kindly said it was like the ideal toilet book or something, which is like, I'd be offended, but you're right. That's exactly what we're going for here.
Well, so one of the reasons why I failed to send a nice thing about it, also because it's terrible, but is because I was on holiday and there was a bath that fit me, which was a very exciting and rare experience. And I thought, it's a very good book to read in the bath and kind of go through and go, oh, I didn't know that. And I mean, the thing it really reminds me of actually is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, not the novel itself, but the actual guide.
We should probably describe the book in a moment because we're just kind of talking about it and no one has any idea. But I am genuinely delighted you say that because that was one of the things I was going for. So like it wasn't a book that I pitched. A publisher was kind of looking for a writer for hire, and I got the gig. And they wanted a book of kind of, you know, facts and lists and, you know, interesting stuff about the world for that kind of old, you know. If it works, it's going to be the book everyone buys their dad in a panic just before Christmas. It's that kind of book. And when I was trying to work out how I would turn this idea into an actual book, the two things I kind of had in mind were firstly this science book I had as a kid published by Osborne, which had, like, you know, cross sections of what the planets look like inside and, like, you know, the planets all lined up behind each other and, like, maps of the human body. You know, the kind of book. But the one that kind of I still remember kind of the sense of wonder about the universe and science and nature that it kind of created in me. So that was something I wanted to go for. And the other thing was I wanted the tone of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the actual book, as you say. So that is, so it is, I'm over the moon that you picked up on that, because it is basically just like, here's a bunch of like mini essays about things I find interesting about the world, written in a snarky tone, basically, is what's going on here. So there's about 100 different mini essays in there, ranging from everything from stories about your creation myths to like how the universe actually came to be in about 700 words, through kind of like the biggest film franchises of all time and the most populated land masses and all those kind of things, and sort of landing on a series of things that might kill us all.
Yeah, I think what I particularly liked about it is the sort of the slightly more, random's the wrong way of putting it, but the ones which are where the list is itself kind of the joy is almost in the title. So, you know, list of things invented by women, which includes central heating, gas-powered central heating invented by an African-American woman, which I just thought was a really cool fact.
That's something that really leapt out to me, that one. It's not just, so like there is a sort of domestic theme to the things invented by women, shockingly, given, you know, ways in which their lives have historically been difficult. But several of the things in that list are African-American women, aren't they? And then you never hear about these guys.
Yeah, well, this is the thing I thought was really fun about that list, right? Isn't, on the one hand, you have kind of, you know, dishwasher invented by a society hostess because she was upset that her servants kept breaking the dishes when they washed them, which is, you know, kind of admirable from intellectual, sort of for an intellectual pursuit perspective, but perhaps not, you know, a kind of particularly sympathetic protagonist.
The class politics of that aren't great.
But on the other hand, yeah, you have loads of African-American women who, presumably, given the time and context, must have kind of like done it part, yeah, kind of like, well, what did you do this evening? Well, I invented gas-powered central heating. What did you do?
It was, I mean, in the writing of it, so I hope in the reading of it as well, a lot of the fun things are the kind of diversions and the footnotes. And another thing I quite liked is when you take something that sounds like it's going to be like a relatively simple list, like how many countries are there in the world, those questions that you think there's going to be an easy answer to, but when you actually start drilling down into definitions, it's surprisingly hard to pin down exactly what counts as a country and how you define that. And you kind of end up with like multiple different possible answers, which are potentially all correct.
The thing I found really interesting, yeah, everyone should go and read it. The weird thing is that, so I do have a special bookshelf of books and don't leave the toilet because I think it's unhygienic for them to, you know, for them to move around the house once they're there. But it's just nice to, you know, have them. So, you know, like if you just, yeah, just, I'm against, you know, sitting and flicking Twitter. I think that's unhygienic. But the thing I'm kind of fascinated about all of them, particularly this, which I think is a brilliant example of kind of sort of a wide ranging book. And you can either enjoy sort of reading cover to cover or sort of flicking through and finding a sort of fun fact. Is that this one, I'm just particularly kind of fascinated by how you went about structuring it, because unlike a lot of these books, it does also actually read well cover to cover, even though I feel like it really shouldn't do, right? The beginning's sort of obvious, right? You start with creation. The end makes sense. You end with apocalypse. But it somehow works as a process throughout. And I just, yeah, just talk me through the kind of, do you have one of those kind of weird sort of conspiracy board things where, you know, you like sit there kind of doing a flowchart with chalk or something?
I have a massive spreadsheet which includes all the articles I never finished as well, because I mean the nature of a book like this is kind of like potentially anything could go in there. So it's a compromise between, you know, what can I actually pull together and what do I really want to be in there within the time provided. I mean, in terms of the structuring, so it's 9 chapters in the end, I think, and it starts off with like the universe and then goes down to sort of the planet Earth, and there's a bit about measurement and a bit about history and, you know, a bit about the natural world. There is a sort of miscellaneous chapter in there for all the stuff I couldn't be bothered to kind of come up with 9 other examples of to turn them into a full chapter in and of themselves. So it's just like, this is the dumping ground. But to be honest, the trick to structuring it was not anything more complicated than you've already spotted, that I kind of start with creation and talk about death at the end. There's a beginning and an end, and in between it's just kind of done thematically. I would love there to be a much cleverer answer to that, but I'm not sure there is one.
Oh, that's a shame. It's very disappointing.
I'm a very disappointing person.
Oh, they are.
But it's not a very disappointing book, and it's available soon, so, you know.
So, actually, the other thing I guess the one thing I found disappointing is I suppose I always saw our relationship in the NS as akin to between that of Arthur Dent. You're obviously Arthur Dent, quintessentially English, kind of cranky, and Ford Prefect, myself, a hoopy frood, knows where his towel is, inevitably would be played by Mos Def in the movie.
This is weird because I think I'm very much at the exact midpoint between Arthur and Ford, because I've definitely got Arthur's social awkwardness and a habit of wandering around in dressing gowns. But at the same time, I do love a party, and I'm not someone you would ever want to be responsible for saving the universe.
Yeah, that's a fair point. But the thing I found sort of, just as occasionally, and when I'm using my iPhone, I'll just be hit by this wave of sadness that Douglas Adams never got to see one. It's actually the first book where I kind of almost wished that I could have it in a format where it would spit out at random intervals and sort of choose a thing and go into it and do sort of its digression. Now, is there going to be some kind of auditory format, some kind of book cast, some newfangled format, perhaps?
This is a wonderful segue for me to tell you about the podcast of Not Quite Everything, which is coming out to accompany the book, which is, as it stands, a series of just 6 episodes with quite random interviewees. But, you know, people I've been very excited to talk to. So I had a very embarrassing incident earlier this week where I found myself in Hendon Park, standing on a wall on one leg, trying to interview the first astrophysicist ever to take a picture of a black hole because of a scheduling conflict at my end and a series of cock-ups. But so I spoke to him. He's called Heino Fuch. I've spoken to Caroline Criado-Perez about the gender data gap. She'll obviously be familiar to NS listeners. I spoke to the historian Alex von Tunzelmann, who's got a book out about the statue wars and the history of statues and their role in imperialism. And it's a series of episodes like that, just kind of, because the book is so random, I thought there was no other way of doing it other than just interviewing some interesting people and kind of topping and tailing it with their favourite facts about their subject or their favourite facts about the world. And I kind of tell them a few things from my book. The other thing worth mentioning is if you do just want the audio version of this book, there is going to be a 13-hour recording of my reading it. So that is another possibility. It unfortunately won't make the pleasing beeping noises of the book from The Hitchhiker's Guide, and I fear that my voice lacks the gravitas of a Peter Jones. But nonetheless, that is an option. You can just hear me read it to you all night, all night. Just go to sleep with me talking to you and wake up with me talking to you too. Isn't that just what you've always dreamed of? Please, Stephen, interrupt me, because otherwise I'm just going to keep going.
I was just really wondering where this was going. I think I'll stick to Max Richter's sleep record. It's great. Like, he plays this kind of very sort of... Well, actually, it's one of those things where I'm always fascinated about Max Richter's sleep record, because you listen to it while you go to sleep and then you wake up and it's still playing. Is what if, like, 4 hours in, there's just silence? How would I know? If I were him, I would have just been like, you're probably asleep right now.
Or what if it's just, like, a voice very quietly telling you to kill someone? Or to, like, send him your bank details.
Yeah, that is possible too, I guess, yeah. But, I mean, I'll never find out. But, yeah, Max Richter's Sleep is actually... I mean, also, people should get your thing too.
They should.
The audiobook of it, or the book, or, you know, whatever format they...
whatever format you're most interested in.
It's interesting. Then, actually, you talk about how it ends with apocalypse. Weirdly, I actually found the bit which... The saddest bit, for me, of the book is actually right at the beginning, because is the kind of stuff about... It's kind of interesting about how big space is. Weirdly, you're kind of like, oh... And I, just as I think some people believe they will never actually die, I realise I do strongly believe I will at some point get to go to the moon. I know that this is not true. I know it's not going to happen. Except I say that and I kind of think like, oh yeah, but I will get to go to the moon.
I know what you mean. Like, there is this sort of section just trying to communicate quite how ludicrously big space is. Followed by, because I'm a nerd, there is a section that's sort of exploring how different science fiction franchises have kind of dealt with the fact that the speed of light is, so far as we can tell, the speed limit of the universe. I find it deeply depressing that the universe is so big and, you know, so vast, and there's so many wonders in it, and it is not built on a human scale. Like there is pretty much no chance, according to the laws of physics as we understand them, that we will ever be able to get out of this solar system, which is one of something like 200 billion stars in one of hundreds of billions of galaxies. It's Star Trek is not going to happen. That's not real. That feels just sad to me.
Well, for many other less depressing facts, do check out The Compendium of Everything, which is out on the 17th of September.
It's out on Thursday the 16th of September from Wildfire Books, and it's brilliant. Please go buy it.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Don't forget, you can now listen to our special Germany Elects podcast series, which explores the campaign, the runners and riders, and the big issues ahead of Germany's election on September 26th. Available now on the World Review podcast feed, and at newstatesman.com/Germany.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
As you say in the book, right, there are lots of sort of wonderful references to other things people should read, including the wonderfully titled How I Killed Pluto and Why I Had It Coming, which is a real book. I hasten to tell listeners, you can actually buy a book with that title. But yeah, you also talk, as you said in part one, about various sort of sci-fi concepts of space travel. And, you know, the ones which are accurate, the ones which aren't accurate, the ones which desperately want to pretend that they're accurate, and the ones which kind of go like, just roll with it, man. What's your favourite science fiction way round the fact that light speed may be the limit of the speed limit of the universe?
Okay, I'm going to go for the hipster answer on this, which is the series of Babylon 5, which was, you know, it's an important bit of TV history because it's one of the first series that was kind of planned as a 5-year story arc, like a novel, which is kind of not that unusual these days in the sort of age of streaming, but in the early 90s, it's very different from most series which are designed for syndication, so you can see them in absolutely any order. Babylon 5 is written as a story, but it's was an important text to me for that reason, but also the way they deal with kind of getting between, you know, one star system and another, the ships have to literally open up wormholes, and it's kind of these blue swirly things which they call jump gates, which looks pretty cool. And As I have always understood it, is kind of like closer to the possibilities of real science than something like the Star Trek warp drive. Although the astrophysicist I was talking about briefly in part one told me that's not real either. There's no evidence whatsoever that wormholes are going to be a thing. So that's sad.
Very sad. I think my favourite sci-fi speed of light thing is the book The Forever War, which is really about Vietnam.
Not about the Labour Party, but tish.
But where the way they deal with it taking so long, and the fact that if it could work, you would probably actually end up travelling in time, is that the home front, you know, they arrive back millions of years in the future every time. Yeah, they arrive back in very different societies in that way than obviously. And again, it's an analogy for like veterans feeling alienated from the society that they're defending. But it's done really skillfully, right down to the fact that when they arrive back at the end, they arrive back basically and they're just like, oh yeah, that war we had bisquillions of centuries ago before we learned how to speak with the other race. Yeah, we still get veterans coming back from that. Welcome to society.
Really?
But it's very good. It's done in a, it's not, doesn't sort of beat you over the head with its bleakness in a way that I think sometimes some sci-fi of that type does. Although actually, this maybe just speaks to my own sort of slight pessimism, but one of the reasons why I think I preferred A Handmaid's Tale to The Testaments is that The Handmaid's Tale, although it ends with that note of optimism and at some point the Gilead regime falls, and you know, I don't care what Margaret Atwood says about it not being sci-fi, it is sci-fi. People need to get over the fact it's sci-fi. Whereas The Testaments is grim in lots of places, but there's a kind of optimism to it and a briefness that it puts on the Gilead regime that somehow means that while it's a brilliant book, it to me isn't quite as brilliant as A Handmaid's Tale, which I think is, to me, the supreme dystopia, which, seeing as your book ends with apocalypses, yeah, what's your favourite dystopia? What dystopia should people go out and buy after they've watched all of Babylon 5, what dystopia should they go out and buy, read or watch?
I really enjoyed the first season of Amazon's The Man in the High Castle, based on the Philip K. Dick novel, which was an astounding piece of, like, it's one of the most painful bits of drama I've ever seen. It's just like you're on the edge of your seat the whole time. It's, for those who are not, I'm sure everyone's familiar, but just in case, it's set in a sort of parallel late 20th century US in which the Allies lost the war. So the west coast of the US is under Japanese control, the east coast is Nazified, and in between there's kind of this sort of no-go area with like moderate freedoms. And it's a great novel, and that was an amazing TV series. That did come out in, I think, early 2016. And given events later in 2016, I decided that I didn't need more dystopias in my life at that point. So I'd never gone back for season 2 onwards. But that was a hell of a piece of television.
So we've talked a lot about the influence of The Hitchhiker's Guide on it. So I was going to say, what to you is your favourite of the six books? I refuse to recognise the... Wait, no, there are only five.
There are only five,
yeah. What's your favourite of the five books? I refuse to recognise the canonicity of the continuation novel.
I think the best novel is... I can't remember what any of them are bloody called. That's really upsetting. Am I... This is my first time in the New Statesman office in ages, and I couldn't remember what reception looked like, and now I can't remember the name of Hitchhiker's Guide novel. Is this me being diagnosed live with early-onset dementia on the New Statesman podcast?
Possibly. I do think there's also
Is it So Long and Thanks for All the Fish? Is that the fourth one?
Yeah, it's the fourth one, yeah.
Yeah, well, which is basically a love story between Arthur and Fenchurch. I think that's the best as a novel.
Yeah, and it really should, I think, actually. In my heart, I think of it as the last one. Mostly Harmless is good, and it has some nice sort of conceits in it.
Well, he was very... it ends on an incredibly depressing note.
Yeah.
Because Douglas Adams was incredibly depressed in 1992 and he wrote it. And like, ideally, I think there would have been another one that kind of undid the depressing ending. But unfortunately, he died before he got round to it because he was not a great one for deadlines. But actually something I really... So after Adams died, when the radio producer Dirk Magg has adapted the last three books as radio serials... Firstly, I think the adaptation of So Long and Thanks for All the Fish they did is absolutely beautiful. Like the soundscaping in that to communicate the experience of meeting the love of your life. It's like it's just a wonderful piece of work. So even if you haven't read the book, go listen to that. It's called The Quandary Phase, I think.
Yeah, it's Quandary Phase.
But secondly, at the end of those, he put an epilogue on, which kind of undid that depressing ending to the whole saga, which is still like, I don't think I've ever listened all the way through to that and not got a lump in my throat at just everything turning out okay and Fenchurch appearing again. Because, you know, if you're listening to the radio episodes back to back, this character's been gone for all of about 2 hours. But if you kind of followed it as a saga and read mostly Harmless when it came out, this character had been gone for something like 15 years. And so it's a really powerful moment to kind of like hear she's back and everything's fine. And I've never listened to that without tearing up a bit. So,
yeah, on the subject of tearing up, sort of final thing to get back to the book, which, yeah, everyone should go out, read for, yeah, get for yourself, get for your own toilet bookshelf. Assemble your own, like, it's great, seriously, even just a pile of them.
What is on your toilet bookshelf?
So, your book, Tom Gald's cartoons, I have.
Oh, those are great.
Yeah, my Far Side box set.
Okay, well, that's very privileged company, I mean, I will take that.
Yeah, you've always got to have a good selection of things, and, you know, because... I mean, I realize this is all such powerful only child energy to just be like, because look, sometimes you just want to spend some time in there. And if other people have to knock on the door and be like, could you please just get the hell out of the toilet so I can do my business in there? Well, that's their problem. Everyone should get a toilet bookshelf. But I think that I'm going to end with my favorite fact from the book, which is actually the list of animals to have been sent into space.
Oh, the only footnote in the book that literally made me tear up in there. Which is the Russian scientist talking about the Laika, the first dog in space, gave a press conference like 25 years later saying like he felt very bad about it because they didn't learn enough to justify the death of the dog. And I was like, that's just the saddest thing I've ever heard in my life.
And you're someone who's not, you know, an animal lover.
You hate animals, don't you? It's kind of part of your brand that you loathe dogs. So.
Loathe is a very strong word. I just, as long as they're not near me and I'm not sort of required to kind of do that, like, oh, isn't he a good boy? Yeah, it just, fine. However people get their kicks, and if making baby sounds at a dog is how people get their kicks, then that's fine. But I don't get it myself. I'm obviously against cruelty to animals, but I'm also kind of against proximity to them. But there is something, even for a sort of animal cynic such as myself, something very powerful about this list of animals, most of whom died, almost all of which are just like, and did we learn anything from? like kind of once just like, well, we've successfully sent a tortoise up there safely. Shall we see if we can send a...
I do think it's a shame there's not more... There is, as far as I can tell, no film footage of the fish they sent into space. Just because I just want to see what that looks like. There was a lid on the tank, don't you mean? Like, the water's not floating away, they're okay. And they're fine, I think they actually came back to Earth okay. But I'm just very, very curious to know how that actually works in practice. Well, this podcast has been very much in the spirit of my book, in that I kind of feel we've gone all around the houses, we've talked about all sorts of things, with no structure whatsoever, and it's been a delight, which is exactly what I've been going for. So thank you very much.
Thanks for coming, and come back to know when you do, you know, the sequel, what, the compendium of more, not quite everything. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush. If you've enjoyed this week's interview, please do go out and buy the book and do leave a favourable review on the NS podcast page. Our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons, and it's recorded and produced by Adrian Bradley.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.